a better way.
Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, today is June the 19th, 2025. And that means we will not have a new episode for you guys. I mean, there'll be a flashback tomorrow, right? And maybe I'll mention it tomorrow, but it won't be like a new episode where we can do an announcement, so I got to do it today. Happy birthday to TSP. Yes, it is. One day before the first day that we ever did TSP together in my car on the crappy recorder. The first episode was like 11 or 18 minutes or something like that. And it was June the 20th, 2008. So we'll just celebrate it today. Happy 17-year anniversary to the TSP podcast and the TSPC communities, because there's more than one TSPC community. We have bifurcated and trifurcated and quadricated and whatever the hell else there is into all sorts of communities and subcommunities. Some have even broken off and gone off to propagate new communities elsewhere. That is one of the biggest blessings I have, that some people have actually made their own thing out of us and then went out and made more. That means we've created something that acts more like an entity than, you know, like a living, breathing entity than just a company. Anyway, I just wanted to share that with you because it is a big monumental thing to have another anniversary for a business. You know, most businesses in the world that are founded don't make it 5 years. You make it 5 years, you're probably going to make it 10. You make it 10, you know, a lot of businesses still don't keep going because the owners cash in or what have you, or they just decide they want to do something else. To get near the 20-year mark is pretty momentous, and I'm pretty excited about it, and I just want to share it with you. So what are we going to talk about today? It is an expert council show because it's Thursday. Got a good lineup for you, but if you're an expert council member listening today, I need more content. I'll be sending an email to that effect very, very soon, but I've got some content from Matt Sersley. I think that's all I got right now. I've got nothing else, so I need content. That means not only do I need the pikers to get me content, I need the piker shakers to send me questions. That's you guys, the audience. Send me a question for an expert council member of your choice. Remember, if you don't know everybody that's on the council, not sure who we have now on the lineup, it's a great lineup. TheSurvivalPodcast.com, the About tab, and the sub menu under there is Meet the Expert Council, and you can find all of them there. Here's who I've got this week. Dan McAdams from the Ron Paul Liberty Report solo. Is Trump turning into George Bush 2.0? I see how that angle comes. I'll have some thoughts on this, too. I don't think so, but it's possible. Matt Sersley will talk about the right structure to own a truck under that's used in your business. Do you have the LLC that is the company on the truck? Do you own the truck? Does it really matter? Matt will answer that for you. And Doc Bones will talk about the implications of violent protests and having a riot survival plan from the standpoint of a doctor's mindset and a survival medic's mindset. And then this just happened. Like, I love when I have two experts talk about the same subject or answer the same question with different perspectives, but I didn't ask for it this time, and they didn't coordinate, and they didn't know. Mike Melito did a segment for us this week on dealing with civil unrest from the perspective of a guy that is a Second Amendment enthusiast, but he's also former LAPD SWAT, and he's also currently now in private security. So it's a little bit different angle. Then Ryan Steva will talk about septic systems in heavy clay soils. Chef Ken Daniels will talk to us about the history of whiskey and what it means to be bottled and bond for a whiskey. What does that actually mean? Then I've got two today because both of them are pretty easy. I keep getting questions, how do I buy Bitcoin? It seems a little crazy to me that in 2025 this is even a question. But I guess it is, so, you know, that just shows you we're still early. Because the process is easy. So can I break it down to five simple steps? So the person can actually go from, I have money in a bank account and I want to own Bitcoin, what do I do? Yeah, I don't even think I need five. We'll see when I get to my segment if I can do it. Then I'll give you three recommendations for places to do it, but I'm going to tell you again, I don't care who you buy it from. It doesn't matter. As long as you can eventually take self-custody, I'm fine. And then another fun thing for me, I have two little fun subjects for you. Crawfish production, just a little update on what's going on with the crawfish production in the garage. and biochar mushrooms. I put out a video. I put out a video last night, and it's just a stand behind the phone, like video the thing in front of you video, the kind I usually do. I don't do high production value videos, but it's because the good folks over at North Spore sent me a Boom Room 2, which is a custom designed, ready to go Martha tent, is what they call them in the mushroom production world, where I can grow mushrooms. And I threw some of their fruiting blocks in there. I just ordered a bunch of other fruiting blocks from our other partner, Mushroom Mountain. I'll be showing videos of and pictures of all the mushroom production we'll be doing, because this thing is a little mini mushroom factory in your house. I mean, you can run like 25 fruiting blocks at one time easily in this thing, and it's very, very cool. But in addition to like these fruiting blocks, which is where you buy the big sawdust block and then you just follow instructions and it makes mushrooms and they grow right out of the block, I've been actually making a lot of my own spawn, and I've talked about it a little bit. With little jars that I'm using, like mycelium from the stems of an oyster mushroom, or you know, maybe another more complex mushroom where I'm just taking a little bit of a sawdust block spawn and then starting a whole new culture with it. But I've seen some of you guys do it too, and I really haven't told you, like, well, what do you do next, right? And you do whatever you want. But what I'm doing is I'll make like a little half pint jar, and to like not get ahead of the mycelium, what I'm doing is making sure it starts and it looks nice and clean. And then every couple days, I add a couple more tablespoons of coffee to that little jar. And I might have four or five of these little jars going with two or three different strains all at one time. When they get completely full and fully colonized, I then break that up, and I go make three or four fruiting blocks from each little jar, because now I've got enough mycelium to really uptake the speed quickly. Some of these get fruited out indoors, or in a bin, or in a tent, or now in my boom room. Some of them go into the garden and get planted, and even the ones that get fruited in the house, like once that block's fruited a time or two, and it's kind of like, it's not spent, but it's like, it's just better off with a new block for the next batch, I'm actually burying them in my garden. Well, I haven't told you what I'm putting into those. I'm using about 50% coffee grinds and about 50% sawdust from wood pellets, like I did in my show, but I'm also adding like about 10 to 20% of the total amount of biochar. And I did that initially because there's been some real promising work using biochar in mushroom spawn cultivation. But now, since those blocks are going in the garden, you see the function stack. So we'll talk about that. Plus my crayfish production. I haven't talked about this at all, other than a side here and there. I've got these marble crayfish that are self-replicating. I just pulled some out of my outdoor systems because it's really hard to tell how well they're working out there. And now I'm growing them in a little mini aquaponics system in my garage, and this is getting really cool. So just a couple really fun things to finish up with today. Anyway, with that, before we get into it, let me tell you something else is cool. Laws of Life is now an audiobook. And when I first put out the book, hell, before I even published it, before you could even buy it, when I said it's coming next month, when's it going to be an audio? Can I get an audio? And it was a little bit annoying, I'll be honest with you guys. Not that I don't want to do what you want, but like for 15, 16 years, I did thousands, tens of thousands of hours of audio. You should write a book. Okay, here's the book. I want it in audio. You see? And then I had all kinds of people wanting to do it for me. And just let me say, all of you that offered, thank you. I appreciate it. But I think people offer to do things like that sometimes and do not understand the time commitment to reading something that will take almost 7 hours to read aloud and get it right and have to fix it and all that. But 2 days ago, I got an email from KDP, which is Amazon's self-publishing platform. And they said, you now qualify for KDP Audio. And I'm like, what the hell does that mean? And so I went and looked at it, and basically you could turn your book into an audiobook with a few clicks. Pick a voice, set a tempo, click publish, and within 72 hours, it'll be live on the sales page on Amazon. So I did it. Is it perfect? No. John Pugliano's name got pronounced a little weird. It actually gets my name right eventually, but the first time it says like Sparko or something. And there's some words pronounced weird, and sometimes it pronounces a hyphen or an underscore, which is supposed to be blank, right? Like, or fill in the blank, and it says fill in the underscore. So it's not perfect. You can sit with it and go through it line by line by line and try to fix it. I didn't. If this was going to happen, this is the way it's going to happen. The thing is, if you go to Amazon on the sales page, you can listen to a sample, and it's pretty much the intro by John Pugliano. But that'll give you, like, do you want it or not? And it is available. And for many of you guys, you know, you have Audible credits and all like I do. You can get it for essentially free. I don't know how that works out for me as the author, but if you can, you can. I also think there's a way you can add on the ebook if you buy the audio for like $1 or $1.99 or something like that. So that's cool too. Anyway, I just wanted you to know that's available, and let's go ahead and jump on into it. It is now time to hear from Dan McAdams on is Trump turning into George W. Bush 2.0 with his foreign policies?
Well, if it feels like deja vu, Dr. Paul, that's because it is. It feels like we're back in 2002, and everything is the same. We have a hapless president who's been bamboozled by the neocons into believing something's true that literally no one else believes is true, at least anyone with any access to it. Now, back in 2002, it was a hapless George W. Bush who insisted when the neocons were around him that Saddam Hussein had WMDs. Who was the person who was the main progenitor of that idea? Well, his name was Benjamin Netanyahu, and he came before Congress and said, I can assure you, without any equivocation, that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Well, he was lying then, and he said the same things about Iran now. It's the exact same thing. And the neocons back then, you remember it very well, Dr. Paul, because you were in the trenches, they cajoled the president by saying, this will be a cakewalk. We're going to be in and out of there within a week. This war will pay for it itself, and they will greet us as liberators when we arrive. Every single one of those statements was a lie. Now, they're doing the same thing again, bamboozling President Trump with the same dog and pony show. The Israelis told him, we will start with decapitation strikes. The regime is so weak in Iran, it is ripe for overthrow. As soon as we take out their top leadership, there will be a regime change, and then we won't have to worry about the nuclear weapons that are coming. This is exactly what they told President Trump, and he was bamboozled like Bush was bamboozled. He said okay. He even admitted that he gave the green light to them to do this. And guess what? Just as with Iraq, it did not work like the neocons promised. The regime did not crumble in Iran, and in fact, the opposite happened. It turns out they can actually fight back, unlike Saddam's Iraq, and they are fighting back. They are hitting Israel with significantly large missiles. They've destroyed fuel depots. They've destroyed the intelligence directorate headquarters. They've destroyed the military headquarters, the Pentagon of Israel, and they continue to fight with impunity. So having been cajoled and lied to by the neocons, President Trump claims the whole thing was about, as you pointed out in your opening, Dr. Paul, nukes. Well, this article just came out from CNN of all places today. If you push this up, Israel said Iran was close to producing a nuclear weapon, but U.S. intel suggested otherwise. Go to the next one. When Israel launched its series of strikes against Iran last week, it also issued a number of dire warnings about that country's nuclear program, suggesting Iran was fast approaching a point of no return in its quest to obtain nuclear weapons, and that the strikes were necessary to preempt that outcome. But U.S. intelligence assessments had reached a different conclusion. Not only was Iran not actively pursuing a nuclear weapon, it was also up to 3 years away from being able to produce and deliver one to a target of its choosing, according to four people familiar with the assessment. So we have the entirety of the intelligence community in the United States saying that Iran is at least 3 years away if they decide, but they haven't decided. And on the other hand, we have Netanyahu telling Trump, no, it's coming within days. And Trump signs on with Netanyahu.
I'm going to say some things that are going to sound like I really disagree with Dan, and I guess a little bit I do, but I'm not disagreeing with the man. I'm disagreeing with the argument. And I'm going to have to say something that's going to sound kind of critical of him. It's just an observation. And that is, there is and Dan's not the only one, there's a whole group of people. The second something involves Israel, They have so much animosity and anger at Israel, and I do too, I just try to keep it in check, that they then have to put their thumb much heavier on their side of the issue of the scale than they normally would. And there's a few things in this. Number one, there's a big difference between a president okaying a strike by U.S. forces versus saying to the leader of another country, if you're going to do that, then I'm not going to do anything about it. Those are different things, and we should see that right from the beginning. So when he says Trump okayed the strike, he's not wrong, but the way that sounds versus the way it actually is, there's a split there. And it's not insignificant that he gave the okay, but it doesn't mean the same thing as ordering a strike. And if you don't start from that vantage point, it all really goes downhill fast from there. The next thing is, comparing Trump to Bush in this with a hapless president who was bamboozled, that's unfair, okay, to George W. Bush in that he's a much more malicious fuck than that would infer. So what Dan just told you is a story that is a fiction about Bush, not Trump, okay? Bush wasn't bamboozled into shit, okay? Bush knew exactly what he was doing, and it was part of a much larger macro plan, and I encourage everybody out there that wants to know more about the real history of what went on in that 8-year period of time and the involvement of people like Dick Cheney in it to go watch the movie W by Oliver Stone. Now, Oliver Stone does not like George Bush. Oliver Stone is very critical of George Bush. You would expect W to be a propaganda film, and at least on a little level, all films about real things are somewhat propagandist. But I'll tell you how I felt after watching the movie. I had a new disdain for George W. Bush. And I also had a new respect for George W. Bush. You see what I'm saying? When somebody shows the positives and the negatives in a storyline, and the person showing the positive and the negative really holds one side of that close to them, but yet they still show the other side, that shows me an even-handed. And Stone is very much known for being very fact-based in his Hollywood productions. That doesn't mean 100%, because you never will be. But the main takeaway from this is that the entire idea of invading Iraq and then Afghanistan and Iraq, the whole thing, was an orchestrated plan. And in Cheney's own words, and this does come from some transcripts, we will go there and we will never leave this time. It was a repositioning of U.S. hegemony and dominance to occupy the Middle East in perpetuity. That was the plan. The way to get there was Iraq invaded Kuwait, and we had 9/11, right? So Iraq invaded Kuwait, that started the old man's first initiative, and then that got done and paused, and then, you know, we're watching Saddam, and is he making WMDs or whatever? Then we get hit with 9/11, everybody's all in on Afghanistan, but we need to expand the war. See, Afghanistan's way over here by, like, India and China and shit. We need a... So they decided to make the case. So Bush wasn't sold on Saddam has WMDs. Bush, Cheney, the whole cabinet, the whole group got together to make the case to the Congress and to the American people and to the UN to get enough of agreement to be able to prosecute the war for the intent of occupying the area. That's what Bush did. That is not what Trump's doing. And so if you know that, and I don't know that Dan does, because it doesn't sound like it, to compare those two things is just like round peg, square hole, but if you push hard enough, it'll go in. Yeah? That's what I see there. So what do I think's going on? I think Trump knows exactly what the deal is. I think that he does believe this bullshit about Iran having nukes, or maybe he doesn't. I don't know. I'm not going to pretend I know something that somebody else knows or doesn't know. But I think that Trump isn't going to do anything. I don't think there's going to be a giant 60,000-pound bunker buster bomb going in. I think Trump is trying to leverage negotiation here. And that's why he says things like, I won't make my decision until the last second. Trump plays the madman. He plays the unhinged guy. He plays the guy, you just don't know what he's going to do. And in this type of situation, that can be advantageous. Maybe it shouldn't be done. Doesn't mean that it can't be advantageous. So I think what Trump wants is a de-escalation. Is it possible he'll send a stealth bomber in, or actually two of them, one with the first bomb and one with the second down the hole? Yeah. And do you really think that Iran has all of their nuclear special stuff in one little spot that they already know exactly where it is on a map, and it's like published with a nuclear, that, really, right? So I think you could go blow that place up. I doubt there's anything in there to lose at this point because the Iranians are not stupid. Now, as far as the Iran fighting back thing, not to the level that Dan is inferring. Iran is getting the shit pounded out of them here. They really are. But they are fighting back, and they can hit Tel Aviv, and they can hit parts of Israel, and they've been doing so. And I'm fed up with the news people. I watched a guy in a retard helmet and a flak jacket yesterday. Oh, the alarms are going off, and the bombs could be coming anything. He's like on a seven-story deck of a building. Yeah, sure, I'm sure you think you're in danger, and you're just that brave. And they're like, I can't believe that the Iranians are hitting civilian targets. Well, the Iranians are shooting missiles that are semi-accurate. Like, you can hit a city, and you might even, with some of them, if they're particularly dialed in, hit a specific building, but most of it is spray and pray. And they're launching about 100 of these missiles at a shot, because it's about as many as they can in one wave. And the Israelis are running out of the ability with our missile technology to knock them out of the air. And they're having to start selecting which ones to knock down, trying to figure out what's being targeted or what's likely to be hit, because you can hit something like an IDF defense facility by accident. You can hit a hospital by accident. You can hit a headquarters by accident if you're aiming at the city. Who knows what you're going to hit? And that's more Iran's level of tech than anything else. They're not guiding missiles into a window like we're capable of. But here's my issue. I keep hearing that, you know, this does not sound like freaking Iraq 2.0 to me. This sounds like Ukraine 2.0 to me. The Israelis are on the verge of victory. The Iranian mullahs are on the verge of collapse. Even the Iranian army is thinking about killing the mullahs and taking over. Regime change. And even if it's not a regime change, Iran will collapse soon. Israel has such superiority. They have full air superiority. You could fly a freaking ultra glider across Iran right now. They have no ability to shoot it down. Israel is mighty and powerful. But they need our help. I'm sorry. Get effed. Get effed. This is where my anger about the whole thing comes out, like Dan's, right? Like, get effed. Either that's true and they don't need us, or they're getting their shit pushed in and they do need us if they're going to win, and that's us taking a side. But this idea, like, if Israel goes, the U.S. is next. What smoking crack-ass MF-er comes up with that, right? Do you not own a globe? Do you not understand? So what you're saying is right now, the U.S. could just flick a switch and just shut off everything in Iran, blow the whole place to shit, completely wipe them out, completely end all the threat ever with one bomb. But if Israel fails, it's what, they're like a superhero? Like the ones that take the other one's power? Like Iran will morph into Nazi Germany World War II with 2025 technology and take over the world? It's the, you know what Dan's right about? It's the same bullshit over and over and over and over and over and over again. Don't fall for it. Don't fall for it. Let's move on to something more interesting to me anyway. You have a business. You know, buy a vehicle. Does the business buy the vehicle? Do you buy the vehicle? Does it even matter? Matt Sersley will talk about that.
Hey, TSP crew. This is Matthew Sersley with AgoristTaxAdvice.com, here to answer another listener question. Today's question has to do with buying trucks and whether you, a work truck, and whether you should do that in an LLC or your own name. So the question is it better to buy the truck under an LLC and get its tax deductions, or better to buy it personally and just pay for the commercial auto policy? Background, we own a cidery. We use the pickup truck for transporting stuff to and from the farm, to and from bars. This is not a full-time income yet. What would benefit us more from a savings and a tax footprint standpoint? Well, this is a question I get all the time, and at some point it's a very simple answer. It doesn't matter who owns the vehicle. It matters how you document it ultimately. You could do it either way and still take the full business deductions. Now, when it comes to vehicles, there's two standard ways, two allowed ways to do deductions for the business use. There's the standard rate, often called the mileage method. And it's very simple. You count up the number of miles you use for the car for business. And in 2025, you take a 70-cent deduction per mile driven. Now, this covers almost everything, If you do this, you don't get to deduct gas, repairs, depreciation, insurance, titling fees, etc. You can still potentially write off the business or the interest, and you can still write off things like tolls and parking, things that have nothing to do directly with the vehicle itself. This is a much simpler bookkeeping method. It is almost always a better method for cheaper vehicles, older vehicles, part-time use vehicles, and can be downright profitable with an electric vehicle where your cost of driving the car is way less than 70 cents a mile. Your other option is the actual expense method. You deduct your actual costs of everything: fuel, maintenance, insurance, gas, depreciation, registration. Anything having to do with the car, you get to deduct the actual expenses of the car. This can include depreciation for new or heavy vehicles, and in some cases you can deduct 100% of the price of the vehicle in year one. I don't love that people try to buy cars just for that benefit, but if you're already buying a new vehicle, it can be a great way to do it. You can only do depreciation if at least 50% of the miles on the car are for business use. And if you depreciate it and then in a later year you don't use it for at least 50% of the mileage, you may have to pay back some of that deduction. The big downside to this method is it requires really good records on anything, particularly if you have a mixed-use vehicle, a vehicle that you do some personal driving and some business driving on. You need impeccable records on this, on all of your driving, where you went, why you went, what was the mileage, because this is something that the IRS does pay close attention to. It's not a red flag, but if there's an audit, if there's a question, this is going to be one of the things you're going to ask for information about. This can be particularly beneficial with a new and expensive vehicle, particularly, again, when that vehicle is almost entirely or is entirely business used. It can also be very good in a year where you have a windfall. If you just made a ton of extra money this year and you're not going to in the future, getting that depreciation now can make a big deal. Now, again, you have to keep track of your business use percentage if you're using it for personal uses as well. Now, if it's 100% business use, it's much, much cheaper. But if it's mixed use, whether it's a daily driver or whether just, you know, you used it to take stuff to the dump from your home, you can only deduct the percentage of business miles. Technically, it is sufficient to be able to document just your business miles. It is better if you can document your business miles and your personal miles. And it is a very good idea, if you have any sort of a business vehicle, to take a photo of the odometer every January 1st or December 31st, so you have some sort of proof as to what the mileage was at the beginning or the end of the year, because that's something we actually do put on the tax forms as well. Again, do not play games with this. If there is ever an audit on this sort of a thing, the IRS is completely brutal on any sort of a mixed-use vehicle. They love to disallow some of the mileage. They love to disallow some of it, the expenses. And if they can show that your business use was less than 50% and you lose that depreciation, it can be a big penalty. Now, should you own it personally through the LLC? Again, tax-wise, it mostly doesn't matter, because generally you can do it either way, particularly for the mileage portion. It's cleaner if you're going to do depreciation to own it through the LLC. There's other benefits to the LLC ownership. It's just much cleaner. There is potentially some liability protection, especially you talk about, if you have employees driving the vehicle, I would definitely have it in the LLC. It just makes it much more obviously a business asset. The downsides is it's more formality, and especially if you need to get a note to buy the vehicle, it can sometimes be more expensive to have the LLC buy it, and you'll still need to co-sign it. Now, with personal ownership, especially for doing mileage, it's way simpler. If you're only doing 20 or 30% of your driving, it's far better to personally own it. And actually, you may or may not need a full-on commercial endorsement. For example, my particular auto policy does allow me to do some business, as long as it's not a rideshare, in my vehicle. Now, it probably wouldn't apply in your case because it doesn't allow me to use the vehicle for transportation of products. But like if I'm just driving around, for example, driving to Jack's workshop and Nicole's workshop, I can use my business, my personal vehicle for that, reimburse myself for my LLC, and it's tax deductible. So it mostly doesn't matter whose name is on the truck. It's about how it's used, how you document it, and you need to reimburse yourself from the LLC ideally. And again, it is a little cleaner if you want to do a write-off on the depreciation. I didn't mention it, but also a write-off on the interest can be cleaner if it's through the LLC. You know, in this case, you mentioned you're not full-time yet. So I would say simpler is usually better. You know, even if the actual expense will save you a little bit of money, you know, if it takes you 30 hours to document it to save, you know, even $300, that's not a good use of your time. So for most people, I do recommend just doing the mileage method unless you're absolutely sure you're going to save a ton of money with the actual method. And then, again, it really doesn't matter whether you own it or whether the LLC owns it. Do whatever is cheaper. You know, if it is mostly, you know, 90% or 100% used for the cider business, and especially if you're buying a new vehicle, I would absolutely buy it in the LLC just to have more options. Now, one other thing, you can go from mileage to actual expenses, but once you do actual expenses, you have to do that every single year for as long as you own the vehicle. So I see this also, again, like, great, I'm going to save an extra $1,000 this year. Yeah, but not only is it more documentation this year, it's more documentation for the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years with that vehicle. So that to me is penny wise and pound foolish. You know, final recommendations, if it's a business vehicle and only a business vehicle, put it in the LLC. If it's your daily driver and you also use it for the business, probably hold on to it yourself. If it's 50-50, do whatever's cheap. Now, everyone, please, if you have a business, head over to agoristtaxadvice.com/TSP. I've got a free guide there with over 60 tax deductible expense ideas for small businesses. Most business owners are missing out on dozens of legitimate deductions and don't even know it. This free download will help you spot the ones you're overlooking right now and save more money now and into the future. Thanks so much.
I'll just say that through all the years, every vehicle that I've ever used for business use, I've simply done the mileage, and it's been a personal vehicle that I deduct mileage for when used for business, and that's pretty simple. Now, the person asked this question, you would have a way heavier use, so you should take everything Matthew said to heart than I would. But, you know, I'd be maybe 20% of the vehicle's mileage would be for business. Today, it's way less than that. It's a fraction of that. I will say this, though. If you do a good job of documenting your mileage and you stick to the mileage formula, which is a really great deduction from a dollar standpoint and a simplicity standpoint, you know, unless you're driving something like a $150,000 Escalade, it's hard to do better than just using the mileage, because if the vehicle qualifies for an appreciation, it really better be dedicated to the business, you know, like 100%. You just get such a good deduction on the mileage. And if you document the mileage and you know the law as to what qualifies and doesn't qualify, that's very hard for the IRS to disprove. Like, they love to go after this the way Matt said, but to go after it from a standpoint of, was this, did you really go here? That's like a very weak position even for the government to be in. So just make sure you're meticulous with your documentation, that you understand the law, as in you have to be engaged in business at the beginning of the trip to count that leg of the trip. So if you went to 4 places, but the first place you left was home, your business doesn't count until you go from the first place to the second place. That's your mileage. Then to the third place, and then to the fourth place. And if you're going back home, that leg doesn't count unless you keep a home office and you go to the home office, commute to the home office on foot, do something business related, documenting your mileage that you did that. And then the trip home, same thing. You get in, put your day to bed when you get there, and document that you did that as well. That's a much better way to make sure you're covered. Do you have to put that with your mileage records? No. Would it hurt if you were audited? No, it wouldn't hurt at all. Anyway, let's move on. Next up, what I got for you is Doc Bones on the implication of violent protests and a riot survival plan. And then the next one is going to be Mike Melito on dealing with civil unrest. Because they're so similar, I'm just going to let this intro be for both of them. I'll play both of them, then we'll come back and we'll talk about some stuff with Ryan Steva next.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net.
You know, demonstrations in the U.S. these days are becoming more frequent and more violent. I haven't been in a protest since the Vietnam era, and that was just on the way to class. I mean, back then, I was fit enough to hightail it out of there when the pepper gas flew. But there's so much civil unrest in the news these days, really every day, that it's a good idea to have a riot survival strategy, whether you're involved and carrying your Save the Whale sign or just a bystander. It goes without saying that your objective should be to stay away from where the violence is occurring. Common sense, right? Of course, if you walk smack dab into a demonstration, things can get dicey pretty fast. Now, I've written a lot about situational awareness, and that mindset will serve you well. Here are some simple tips that will help you avoid injury at a protest. Well, one, you should always be in a state of yellow alert. Yellow alert simply means that being aware of your surroundings, that situational awareness is very important, and also aware of not only your surroundings, but the people around you. When people are behaving strangely, take note and avoid them. Read my article or watch my video on the OODA loop. The OODA loop, developed by an Air Force colonel named John Boyd, is a decision-making model used to quickly assess and respond to situations, particularly in dynamic or competitive environments. It stands for Observe, Orient, Decide, and Act. By repeatedly cycling through these four stages, you can adapt more effectively to changing circumstances. Always mentally map out routes of escape as you walk along. Where is the nearest side street? Is there a building or a subway entrance that'll get you off the street? If you don't know the area, move away to where you do know the lay of the land. If you have to make your way through the crowd, you want to stay on the fringes. Don't get caught in the masses of people surging away or towards the violence. If you do, they are deciding your movements, not you. Avoid confrontation with protesters. In other words, take off your Make America Great hat if there are 500 anti-Trumpers that are in front of you and looking unhappy. That is, of course, unless you're ready to rumble. You might consider having a bandana handy. This essential survival supply isn't a gas mask per se, but it works at riots where tear gas is sprayed. Some advocate the soaking of the cloth in with lemon juice or apple cider vinegar. You want to wear sneakers or other footwear that are going to allow you to have the most mobility. The only women wearing heels at these things are reporters, so make sure you're well clothed so that most of your skin is protected. You'll need to wash clothes thoroughly that have been exposed to things like tear gas or just throw them away. You also want to be aware of the movement of law enforcement officers. You really don't want to approach them if you don't have to. Their job is tough enough, and they won't be able to hear you above the roar of the crowd. They won't know you're friendly. If you have to approach them, show them your hands. Make sure they know that your hands are empty. Don't run if you can help it. Now, unless everybody else is running, you are going to attract unwanted attention, so walk fast and purposefully, that's fine, to get around a corner or to higher ground or some other safe spot. In truth, you want to be inconspicuous. This may be difficult if you're 6'8", but otherwise, do your best to be what we call the gray man, that is, to be as invisible as possible. Now, if you're with friends, stay together. If you can't be together, agree on a meeting place beforehand in case you wind up getting separated moving through the crowd. You want to avoid being caught against walls, fences, blockades, or other solid objects. People can get crushed by masses of protesters trying to escape a tear gas attack. You might consider carrying some milk, water, or diluted liquid antacid like Maalox or Mylanta in some kind of container if you know you're going to be heading into a protest area, especially if you're participating. If sprayed with tear gas, you want to move quickly into an area of fresh air and pour the liquid on your face, especially your eyes. Drink it if you get sprayed in the mouth. Milk or liquid antacid is thought by some to work better than just water, but honestly, there's no hard data one way or another. The effects of the tear gas will resolve over a short time in most cases. Now, if you're part of the protest itself, carry a basic medical kit that will help to treat injuries like bleeding or burns, not only on yourself, but in the folks around you.
This is Joe Alden, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, the essential guide for when help is not on the way. And get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
What is going on, TSP? Did not get a question this week for a segment, so I thought I would do a brief segment on civil unrest. Without rehashing the entire bio, I was LAPD. I was U.S. Marine Corps Infantry. I have dealt with civil unrest, both foreign and domestic. I also currently work as a private security contractor, and I have been busy. So I thought I would throw in some things to maybe be aware of, because apparently it's civil unrest season in America. Number one, I'm going to briefly mention this because I know Jack harps on it, but it really is more important than the stuff I'm going to talk about. Don't be there, right? There are techniques for getting punched in the face so it doesn't hurt as much. It's in your head for it, so you take it on the forehead, not the nose or the cheekbone. But you know what's better? Moving your head out of the way before the punch comes, right? Maybe don't be there. That said, you may end up there for whatever reason. But maybe be circumspect and pray on, meditate on whether it's worth it to be in that location if you can avoid it. Just because you legally have the right to do something doesn't mean it's always a good idea. Okay, that out of the way. Real common sense thing, don't let your gas tank get below half. We all do it from time to time, but a good practice is keep your gas tank, even in normal times, above half a tank. You never know, you get an injury or something, that's not the time to worry about if you have enough gas to get you to where you need to go. You know, the day that there's a civil unrest wherever you work in the city, you know, maybe you drove to work and your gas light was on, you're like, I'll get it on the way out. Well, maybe you won't be able to. So again, real common sense, keep your gas tank above half. Of course, you should have like spare gas and stuff in your car, but you may not want to stop and put it in. So just a real easy way, just treat the halfway point like that's empty for you. It's a good idea all the time, but especially if you're in the bad habit of letting your gas tank go to empty, keep it at half. Because even if you think you can make it a home on a normal day in that amount of gas, if you're in stop-and-go gridlock traffic, you may not. What I said about the gas tank, your cell phone battery. Maybe it doesn't have to be half, but don't let it go all the way to the yellow or the red. I can speak from personal experience. I've had an experience where I actually had to bug out. And guess when my phone battery was almost dead, trying to get a hold of my wife and then trying to find a charging cable. That is not the time to need to worry about charging your phone. So, and if you're bad about it normally, I would say maybe try and work on that. But especially, I mean, I have to deal with this. Keep your cell phone at a decent charge level, whatever you think is acceptable to you, 20%, 30%. But don't let your cell phone run all the way down. Yes, have a backup battery and have a charging cable, but the best thing is to not need that and have enough charge to get you out of the situation. And also, quick tip, a lot of times when there's a mass event, cell phone coverage will go down and calls will go down because everybody is trying to call at once. You can try and send a text may go through and a call will not. Another thing you may want to consider is four-wheel drive. If you have a couple of vehicles and one has four-wheel drive, even though it may not get as good a gas mileage, in times where you think it may be an issue, drive the four-wheel drive to work. There are, and I'm not telling you to break traffic laws normally, but there are like traffic law suggestions, and there's what's governed by the laws of nature. Like if you have to drive on a shoulder or on a median to get out of an area, if it's going to save your life, then probably do that. A four-wheel drive makes a curb like a suggestion, whereas in a Prius, it's kind of mandatory. Something like four-wheel drive may turn something like the access road where railroad tracks are a good avenue of egress. So, if again, have a four-wheel drive, I'm not telling you to go out and drop, you know, 70 grand or whatever on a new truck, but if you have a vehicle that's four-wheel drive and you don't normally drive it to work, being times like this, if it's in an area where you are, consider the four-wheel drive. It could open some doors for you. Speaking of opening doors, lock picks and bolt cutters, not for anything nefarious, not even for getting into something, but getting out of a place, not encouraging you to vandalize. You know, if you cut somebody's chain and it turns out to be nothing, maybe go back later and pay them double what it's worth or replace it. But if you have to get out of an area and it comes between you cutting something and getting out alive, deal with, and I'm telling you, you should go back and make it right later, but at the time, getting out was important. Also, lock picks, that's just a good life skill in general. Have lock picks, know how to use them. If you normally leave them at home, maybe keep them in your vehicle or maybe part of your EDC or EDC bag. But if you have to pick a lock, again, not for anything nefarious, it comes in handy just in life. But in something like this where you're trying to get out of an area, generally lock picking doesn't even hurt the lock. And this is a survival podcast. I'm sure you're familiar with the different kind of bags, right? And there's all these acronyms for bags. My EDC bag, my get-home bag, my bug-out bag, my inch bag. If you have one of those kind of bags, and I don't care what you call it, maybe keep it in your vehicle. If you're commuting to work in the city, and bag is at home, and you're stuck in gridlock traffic, and your vehicle's stuck, that bag may as well be on the moon. Whatever your plan is for getting out, you should have a man-portable option. Meaning if you can get out in a vehicle, great, but if you need to go on foot, then go on foot. And a bag can help give you some more capability there. So if you already have a bag, this is not the time to hash out everything that should be in a bag, but you probably have listened to Jack long enough to have a good idea. Maybe have that in the car, in the vehicle, and have it somewhere where you can grab it when you have to get out of the vehicle if you have to get out quickly. And since I am the gun person on the expert council, I'm big on EDC, I'm big on everyday carry, I am personally big on, if you listen to my own podcast, the Gunfighter Life podcast, I harp on carry a fighting handgun, carry a full-size fighting handgun when you can. Handguns are inherently hard to use anyway, smaller handguns are harder to use. There's a time and a place, and I love my Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum J-frame. Maybe that's not the right tool for the job for this. So, again, if you have really good fighting handguns, don't normally carry one, I would say maybe consider that. In times like this, maybe consider the larger option. Now, guys, I just want to kind of close with this. Don't live in fear. Don't be anxious. Don't worry about tomorrow, but be prepared. And one thing from my experience I can speak to is that things like this can happen quickly. Maybe in your area, if there are protests, maybe they've been peaceful so far, but an incident, randomly, let's say law enforcement officer, right or wrong, shoots somebody of the inappropriate, whatever that means, and this is not to get into politics, but they shoot somebody, or there is a shooting, somebody of a wrong socioeconomic, racial, whatever kind of community, and there's an outrage. That stuff can happen quickly, and it can turn very quickly. And things can escalate very quickly. Just keep that in mind. Anyway, with that, I hope this was helpful, and I hope that you don't need it. Thanks, Jack. Thanks, TSP, and have a blessed day.
Let me just say, I want more stuff like this, Expert Council guys. I do. Like, I don't mind if you guys coordinate together to do it. I mean, if I get a question and I think it fits, I'll send it to who I think it fits, including multiple parties, and that's great. But if you guys want to come up with some stuff on your own, a lot of you guys talk back channel, do it. I think this would be fantastic. And the only thing I would ask is don't listen to each other's response. Don't know each other's response, because that makes the responses completely organic. And it means there'll be some overlap and some divergence, which there was there. Because I guarantee you that Mike and Doc Bones, I don't think have ever spoken, right? So there was no coordination here. But I like the idea of doing more of this. I think it helps people get a better understanding of the situation to have multiple perspectives on it. All right, now let's move on and hear from Ryan Steva on septic systems, particularly in complicated situations like really heavy clay soils or impermeable ground and things like that.
Hey, TSP community. This is Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today, I've got a question from Nate, who asks, what options are there for septic system in clay or impermeable soils that don't rely on a pump? Nate goes on to clarify that his house uses what's called a sand filter as part of his septic system, and that it currently requires a pump. He also had a septic guy who told him that sand filters all eventually clog and need replacement, and that it's often cheaper just to replace the system with a mound system or other pressurized system than it is to remove and replace the sand filter. So Nate also says that he'd like to remove the reliance on an electric pump so that in times of a power outage or equipment failure, he doesn't have to worry about that anymore. And he also notes that they have a few dozen feet of grade drop in the area around the house, if that can matter for consideration. And Nate, it does. It's really helpful and good information, and it will make a big difference in what you can do. A couple of notes that I'm sure, Nate, you've thought of, but could be really helpful if you haven't for some reason, is to keep a small generator on hand. I know that you'd like to replace your system with a passive system, and there's a great option out there, but in the meantime, unless your system is looking like it's going to fail, having a small generator on hand that you can plug the pump directly into is a really great idea. You could also consider something like critical load solar backup for your home, which would include also maybe your refrigerator and freezers and some lights in the house, maybe a couple other small things like your internet. If people are interested in a critical load solar system as a much less expensive option for keeping their systems up and running during long and ongoing outages, let Jack know. I can cover that, and I would love to cover that in a segment, and I don't think it's really been broached or talked about much on the show. Another thing, Nate, to have is to have a backup pump or an extra pump on hand. It's kind of gross, but a lot of times those pumps are actually homeowner replaceable if you know what you're doing and you're a bit handy in an emergency. Of course, I would still have a professional do it if you're not in an emergency, but just having the pump on hand means that nobody's going to have to order anything, and you're going to be charged a lot less for it. You're probably going to be charged double or triple by the installer for what the price of the pump actually is. So what you can put in, Nate, most likely, is a passive mound system. So it's a mound system. A lot of them require pumps, but because you have enough drop in your elevation, you should be able to install a passive mound system. You're still going to need to talk to a qualified installer and professional to make sure that that is going to work well in your specific scenario, but most likely it will. Passive mound systems are great for things like shallow water, high water tables, clay or impermeable soils, as well as environmentally sensitive areas. So they have several advantages. One being that they're passive, meaning that you don't have the pump, so if power's out, they still work. And two is that, like I said before, they're really good for poor soil sites. They do, however, have a few limitations. They're a little bit more complex than a typical system, and they're going to be a bit more sensitive and have be a tiny bit more prone to failure or damage than a traditional in-ground system would be. They also have a larger footprint, so it requires a bit more space above ground to install these. Depending on the situation, some systems may require professional maintenance, whereas others might be fine. It's going to depend on your site-specific potential issues, as well as how it's installed, what materials are installed, and what your local government requires as well. There is some general maintenance to use to keep your whole system in the best shape possible, so I'm going to run through those fairly quickly. Generally speaking, you want to have your septic tank, the tank itself, pumped every 3 to 5 years, depending on household size and usage. This keeps or prevents solids from reaching and clogging the field lines, and that's a really important point. So if you don't get your septic pumped often enough, it can cause some real major issues because those solids end up down the line and that ends up clogging the system. you will want to do a mound system evaluation or inspection on your own every year or less. You're going to be checking for surface effluent, so wet spots and odors, erosion, settling of the mound, things like that. If your passive mound system has an effluent filter, that's going to need cleaning either once a year or per manufacturer's instruction. And you're going to want to maintain shallow-rooted grasses on top of the system. You don't want anything that's perennial or deep-rooted because it will get the roots in there and actually start destroying it. You also want to manage any surface water runoff to assure that it is not running directly at the mound system because that will cause damage as well. So, Nate, as tempting as it may be, you want to make sure not to use your mound system as a four-wheeler jump or to drive any other heavy vehicles on top of it. That will damage it quite quickly. And generally, for septic systems in general, you want to avoid flushing grease, wipes, or chemicals. Those will greatly reduce the lifespan of your septic tank. Well, that's it for me, Nate. If you have any follow-up questions, feel free to reach out. Thanks, everybody, and I hope you have an excellent week.
I'm not going to disagree with anything he said. I just want to say this about septics in general. The idea that something worked for 50, 100 years, and now today it doesn't work anymore, it's kind of stupid, and it's typical of a lot of things, and it's very typical in septic. And it doesn't necessarily apply to the specific question here. It just made me think of this, and I wanted to bring it up. So if I was building my house today, they would tell me a standard septic tank system with lateral lines out into a field would not work because it's very shallow here and it's all rock and you can't do it and you have to get, you know, an aerobic system with sprayers and blah, 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 blah. Okay, but when I moved in here and this house was built in 1978, they put exactly what they said doesn't work here in here. And it absolutely does work here. And we did have a year where we had a massive amount of rain, and I mean a massive amount of rain. We had, I think, 29 days of measurable rainfall in the month of May. I think there's 30 days in the month of May, 30 or 31. Either way, like, we had almost, you know, every day there was rain. I mean, that just doesn't happen here, and it did. It was so bad that David Siegler made a Photoshop image of, like, marlins and sharks and a Loch Ness monster swimming around in my yard. We had the septic tanks, the liquid tank specifically, but really both of them, it backed all the way up, overflowing. We brought in a truck. They pumped as much out as they could, which needed to probably be done anyway. You should have your septic tanks pumped every so often. And as the guy's pumping it, water's just pouring in and pouring in. Well, the company comes and looks at it, and they tell me, this is shot. The lines are clogged. Wait a minute. The lines are clogged, but you're pumping water out of it, and it's actively coming in. I don't think so. So what I did, I took a cheap sump pump, you know, like a dirty water sump pump, threw it in the front tank, the liquid tank, ran a garden hose all the way to my back fence through the woods, and just let it pump that water and pump that water and pump that water and pump that water and pump that water so that it wouldn't back up anymore until that stopped, until the flood. It was a flooding event, so of course it's going to flood things below ground. Went away, and that was in 2016 or 2017. And you know what I've done to my septic tank ever since? I had it pumped one more time because you should have it pumped about every 4 or 5 years. And you know what it does right now? It works flawlessly. Right, so they would tell me it cannot be done today, even though I've got a system. If you go back to 78 to today, it still works flawlessly. So just know that if you have any flexibility when it comes to what you're actually going to do for your septic, that some of the things that professionals who sell systems to you or government bureaucrats who know very little will tell you, this can't be done, and sometimes it can. Again, it's not really relevant to this particular question directly, but it is something you should know. Especially, it's one thing if you're putting a new system in. Would it be a better system to do what they said today if I was installing it? Yeah. Do I need to spend thousands and thousands of dollars to put a completely new system in when I have a functional one because some idiot with a clipboard told me? No. So if you have a functioning system and you have a problem with it, before you blow it up, make sure you need to. Because all I needed was a $95 pump and a couple weeks for the flooding to go away. Let's take another one. This time we are going to hear from, who are we going to hear from? We're going to hear from Chef Ken Daniels on what Bottled in Bond. It sounds kind of like S&M shit, doesn't it? Bottled in Bond, right? Well, whiskey, what is that?
Hello all, Chef Ken here. Today's question comes from Mark. He asks, you mentioned your involvement in the whiskey industry. I was wondering if you can explain Bottled in Bond. Mark, I can help. Bottled in Bond is more than just a phrase on a label. It's a legal classification founded in 1897, created to protect both drinkers and distillers, and more than a century later, it still matters. Before the Bottled in Bond Act, whiskey wasn't just unregulated. It was dangerous. Some of the counterfeit spirits sold in the late 1800s weren't even whiskey. They were industrial alcohol, cut with chemicals, and flavored with everything from tobacco spit to sulfuric acid. In some cases, the final product was colored with burnt sugar and dosed with opium or turpentine. People weren't just getting swindled. They were getting poisoned. There were documented cases of paralysis, seizures, and death. Not from drinking too much, but from drinking the wrong thing, sold under the right name. And because there were no laws requiring ingredient disclosures, no aging standards, and no enforcement, consumers had no way to know the difference between a barrel from a legitimate distillery and a bottle filled with doctored grain neutral spirit cooked up in a back room. It wasn't just a market problem. It was a public health crisis. And it wasn't just the drinkers who suffered. Honest distillers, those who were aging whiskey properly, storing it in oak barrels for years, and bottling it without additives, were getting crushed. Why spend 4 years aging a barrel when someone else could turn a profit in 4 days with a kettle, a funnel, and a label? That was the reality that pushed people like Colonel E.H. Taylor to demand protection. Not just for distillers, but for drinkers. The Bottled in Bond Act changed that. It wasn't a safety net, it was a line in the sand. For the first time, the U.S. government said, we will stand behind this product. And that mattered, because when you stamped Bottled in Bond on a label, you weren't just talking about strength or age. You were telling the consumer, this won't kill you. This won't lie to you. This is what it says it is. And that promise didn't just elevate whiskey. It laid the groundwork for everything that came after, from the Pure Food and Drug Act to truth in labeling standards to the concept that government could, on rare occasions, protect the public from private fraud. Bottled in Bond wasn't just a whiskey law. It was the beginning of consumer rights in America. And that's worth remembering every time you see that label. And while that label carries a lot of weight, it also leaves room for misunderstanding. So before we talk about what to buy, let's be clear about what Bottled in Bond doesn't mean. Here's what Bottled in Bond is not. And this is important. It's not a flavor profile. It doesn't tell you the whiskey will be spicy or sweet or smooth or rich. It doesn't guarantee you'll love the taste. What it guarantees is quality in production. So if you're walking down the whiskey aisle and you see hand selected or craft distilled, understand this. Those terms are marketing, not law. They can mean something or nothing at all. Bottled in Bond is different. It's federally regulated. It can't be faked without breaking the law. But that doesn't stop brands from trying to confuse you. They might say bonded style, or in the tradition of Bottled in Bond, they might highlight 100 proof on the front label. But if it's not specifically labeled Bottled in Bond and it doesn't list DSP numbers or meet all the criteria, it's not bonded. And here's another thing. Just because it's Bottled in Bond doesn't mean it's high end. Some of the most budget-friendly whiskeys on the shelf are bonded. That's a good thing. It means access to quality isn't limited by price, but that also means you still have to know what you like. You can have a Bottled in Bond that's youthful, hot, or aggressive. You can also find one that's smooth, elegant, and layered. The label tells you the rules were followed, not a guaranteed taste, so read past the buzzwords, ignore the packaging, and don't assume price means quality. Let's talk about what Bottled in Bond actually is, and certain laws distillers are required to follow. Here's what it requires, legally, not optionally. 1. The whiskey must be the product of one distillation season, either January to June or July to December. Everything in the bottle must come from that single six-month window. No mixing across years or batches. 2. It must be distilled by one distiller at one distillery. That means no blending across producers or facilities. And if the whiskey was bottled somewhere else, the bottler must still disclose the DSP numbers, the registered plant codes for both the distillery and bottling location, right on the label. 3. It must be aged for a minimum of 4 years, but not just anywhere. It must be stored in a federally bonded warehouse under government oversight. Historically, the government even held the keys. 4. It must be bottled at exactly 100 proof, which is 50% alcohol by volume. No rounding up, no dilution below the line. 5. It must be bottled in glass containers only. That's right, no plastic, no cans, no novelty packaging. Glass is required to preserve integrity and prevent contamination. 6. It must be bottled at a federally bonded facility. That means the bottling process itself must happen under the same regulatory standard as the aging. 7. No additives are allowed. None, no artificial coloring, no sugar, no flavorings, The only thing that can be added is water to bring the proof down to 100 if needed. 8. The label must list both the distiller and bottler by name or registered DSP number, so the whiskey is fully traceable. No smoke, no mirrors. These rules aren't just for show. They were designed to create confidence in the product and in the process. Bottled and Bond gave honest distillers a way to separate themselves from bootleggers, and it gave consumers a reason to believe what they were drinking wouldn't make them sick. Over the years, it became a gold standard, a quiet badge of integrity. Eventually, it faded from the spotlight, but recently, it's made a comeback because people are tired of gimmicks and guesswork. Consumers want labels that mean something. For bartenders, Bottled and Bond whiskeys are reliable, that 100 proof holds up in cocktails. It gives structure to an old-fashioned or Manhattan without getting lost. For collectors and whiskey fans, bonded bottles offer transparency and trust. You know exactly where it came from, when it was made, and how it was handled. And for everyday drinkers, these bottles often deliver some of the best value in the whiskey aisle. Here are a few great ones to look for. Old Granddad Bottled in Bond, Evan Williams Bottled in Bond, Rittenhouse Rye, Henry McKenna, if you can find it. And don't forget, Bottled in Bond doesn't just apply to bourbon. It can also apply to straight rye, wheat, or corn whiskey, as long as it follows all the rules. If you like rye, grab a Rittenhouse. It's spicy, bold, and made for cocktails. So why does Bottled in Bond still matter? Because in a spirits industry full of vague claims and marketing fluff, this one label still means something real. It means the whiskey was made the hard way, the legal way, the right way. That phrase, Bottled in Bond, isn't just a nod to history. It's a commitment, and it's earned. I hope this helps explain Bottled in Bond. Bottled in Bond wasn't just about whiskey. It was about drawing a hard line between real and fake, and putting that line into law. For once, regulation protected the public. Bottled in Bond is proof that standards still matter, and that sometimes the system gets it right. So next time you see it on a shelf, remember, you're not just holding whiskey, you're holding history. Remember, if you've got more questions about food or drink, you can always find me at drinkeatlearn.com and bloodsugarchef.com. Until next time, this is Ken, the Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers!
I'll be the first to admit, there have been times in history where our government, including the federal government of the United States, has done things that have been beneficial for consumers and the general public. They're few and far between. This is actually one of them. As the anarchist in me would say, and we could totally have a private certification program that would do something similar to this or better, but it is what it is. And for the time, it was well done. And it still is a valid thing, probably because it was done so long ago. Anyway, moving on. I want to answer a question. I had a person email me. And exactly what they said doesn't matter, because I've gotten quite a few of these emails. And I don't do this a lot, because I kind of feel like people are intentionally making something hard that isn't. But I also realize when you've never done something before, then all these but what ifs get in your head. I'll mess it up. I'll screw it up. The world will end. I don't know. Dogs and cats will combine and rain puppy kittens from the sky and cause the apocalypse, right? But basically, how do I buy Bitcoin in simple terms? Like, I just want to buy Bitcoin and I don't know how. Okay, this is where, again, I say, I don't really care who you use to do this, but as much as I recommended Coinbase in the past, it's very easy, but it's like one of the most expensive ways to go. Okay, so including when you want to get your Bitcoin out, then there's more fees and blah, blah, blah. Now, just if you're going to use Coinbase, just by switching to advanced mode, which is literally clicking a button, just by doing that, your fees will go down, just so you know. Anyway, the main places I would say to look would be things like Strike. You could stack Bitcoin really inexpensively with Fold. You could do it with Swan. And I have links in the show notes today to all three of those. If you're going to sign up for one you haven't already, please consider using my link, because I gave you the advice and I don't hate money. But I mean, you know, River, you can buy Bitcoin in freaking PayPal. You can buy it with, I think, Block. You can buy it with Square. You can buy it on Robinhood. Like, all I would say, and I don't know all these platforms, I don't use them, just make sure that the option exists. And you can do this with a Google search or reading the FAQ of the provider. Can I take my Bitcoin off your platform? If the answer is no, don't do it. As long as you can, I don't care who you buy from. So sign up with one of these companies. You then, and this person said, I want to get money out of my bank account in there. Many of these companies will let you do deposits with, you know, out of your PayPal account or with a credit card or whatever. There's usually a significant fee to that. So that's going to increase your cost by increasing your cost, even though it's not a direct thing. If I had to pay 1.5% to move the money in, I added 1.5% to my cost, even though it's not in the purchase. Usually the best way to do this is to link your bank account so you can do an ACA transfer. This will often take time, and then some companies have different rules about it. For instance, Strike, if you move your money from your bank account into Strike, as soon as it gets there, in seconds, you can buy Bitcoin with it. What you can't do then, though, for 2 weeks is send that Bitcoin. They verify the transaction will go through. They're waiting for the back end, and they're putting a buffer on it to make sure nobody's committing fraud. So I've had people, they keep your money. They won't let, no, you didn't read the terms. I just gave them to you. And other companies have similar things where maybe the money's there quickly, but you can't remove it until the backside of the transaction that you don't see has closed. But that's usually the best way, is an ACA transfer. There's also services like Strike. You can have, if you get paid with direct deposit, you can go to your HR Karen, get another form, and say, I want 5% of my check deposited directly into Strike every paycheck. And that's another easy way to get it in there. So I'm just saying that's how you get your money in. Once your money's in there, however that platform works, you click buy Bitcoin. And you say how much you want to buy, and you buy it. You've now bought Bitcoin. You now own Bitcoin. And it would be a great idea for you to get something like at least a software wallet, okay? And for a software wallet, I recommend Exodus. And I don't recommend it because it's the best wallet in the world. I recommend it because they actually are a real company with real people, with real customer support, and I am not your customer support representative, and I refuse to be one. I'm not hand-holding every boomer that wants to buy. I'm sorry, I'm not hand-holding every boomer that wants to buy Bitcoin through every step of the situation. So if you get a problem with your wallet, or you don't, I want a company that will answer your question, and Exodus will do that. But you don't even need to worry about that. You know, I'm a huge self-custody advocate. I really am. And that means you hold your keys and you hold your Bitcoin. But you know how many people have had their Bitcoin taken away from them while they were holding it in Strike? Not really, I can't find one. The other thing is, I'm not even going to tell you that you need to worry about taking self-custody until you have at least $1,000 or roughly about 1 million sats, right? Which is the smallest unit of a Bitcoin is a Satoshi, also called a sat. So initially, most people aren't going to go initially buy $1,000 worth out of the gate. You'll buy small amounts. I really recommend if you use a program like Strike to buy. And I will say that sometimes when you set up a Strike account, you try to link your bank account, something goes wrong, you don't get approved, and sometimes you can't get anybody to help you. And they tell you something like, we can't do anything. It's bullshit, but it's what the CSRs are told, and it's what they believe, and then you need to find another platform. Why? Does it happen? I don't know. I set up a Strike account. It was flawless. My wife couldn't do it. Same bank account. Well, not same bank account because we knew not to use the same account. Same bank. Same bank. Can't do it. Can't get any help. So I understand that. It's fraud prevention. These are big companies. They use third-party services for this, and they wash their hands of anything that doesn't go through the filter. So if Strike doesn't work, try Swan. If Swan doesn't work, try Strike. If you don't want either one of those and one of them doesn't work and you don't want the other one, try River, even though I haven't used it. And I really recommend at this point in the game, there's so many places that you can do this. If I wanted to buy $1,000 of Bitcoin right now with Bitcoin near an all-time high, I would probably do something like take 1,000 divided by the total number of days, let's say 60 days, and I'd do a daily DCA of small amounts. And if I had a lot, I would put 10,000 in, I might do that over 90 days. I might do that over the rest of the year. I mean, right now I buy about $10 a day in Bitcoin. I was doing 5, then I did 7. Now I'm doing about $10 a day in Bitcoin. I just throw $100 in there out of whack. Again, bank transfer, no fee. And then 10 days later, I throw another $100 in there, and it just auto buys every morning about 6 o'clock in the morning. I wake up, I already bought Bitcoin. I recommend that approach. But if you just want to buy a couple $100 worth, that's all you do. It's transfer your money. And click buy. And when you want to withdraw money, again, these companies all have support that will help you with that. But basically, you get a software wallet, you generate an address, you say, send the money here. That's it. Don't lose your keys. I'm not going to get into full custody and key management and everything today. But that's how you buy it. The other way you can buy it, I know some people hate this, and I'm not a good Bitcoiner for saying this or whatever. You can shut up, because I don't want to hear from your bullshit. If you have an IRA that you control, buy a freaking ETF. There's actually no reason not to buy an ETF with IRA 401k money and try to force self-custody inside. It's just dumb. There's full visibility in there anyway. It doesn't matter, and it's quick, it's instant, and the fees are stupid low that way. So there's no reason that you can't own Bitcoin ETFs inside an IRA, and that's just like picking a different fund or picking a different ETF. It's all it is. And so don't be afraid to do that either. Now, I do think everybody should get into the self-custody world as well, but again, man, the ETFs are for what ETFs are for, and retirement accounts is a perfect example of that. And the same person like, well, don't do that. Well, do you have an IRA? Uh-huh, yeah, I do. Right? What do you got here? Well, I got this ETF fund on large-scale stocks and growth and income. Just shut up. You shouldn't be allowed to talk to people if that's you. Okay, that's how you do that. Again, there's links there. And I'll also put a link to my Bitcoin tools page at thebitcoinbreakout.com where you can find that as well. All right, so now some fun stuff. Number one, I've been playing with these self-cloning crayfish for a while. And what I did is, some of you have been here and seen it, I have a 40-gallon breeder fish tank out of my garage, and then like a little 10-gallon tray ebb and flow bed set up with it on a pump on a timer. And I use it mostly for propagation. Like right now I've got ginger in it to get it to sprout before I put it in the garden because you get better results that way. I'm making sweet potato slips with it and some other stuff. It's just kind of there as an educational tool. When people come here, this is how it actually works because you can get underneath. You can see all of the moving parts. And I had a bunch of fish in it. Well, I took them all out, and I went out into my outdoor system that last year I threw like 6 marble crayfish in. Put a bunch of pieces of pipe in there as crayfish traps because they like to go in there. And I got like 4 or 5 of them and threw them in the tank. And so that's the whole thing. And I've been feeding them algae tablets and all. Well, just today I was out there and I see little crayfish, way smaller than the ones I put in there, crawling around. So they're starting to reproduce. And so I'm going to be ramping up production of these things. They do not get as big as like the crayfish that we're accustomed to, like the really big crayfish that they have at crayfish bowls and all. They get about 80% of that size, though. They certainly get big enough to make an edible tail. They've become a major food source in Madagascar. Now, what's unique about these? Again, these are called marble crayfish. They're also called self-replicating or self-cloning. They're all basically hermaphroditic. They do not need a partner to breed. There is no male and there is no female. They are really ZZM, right? They actually are ZZMs, right? Like, it's not made up pronouns. They're all ZZMs, which means they can all reproduce without a mate. In fact, they do reproduce without a mate. They don't mate. They just make their own. It's some weird mutation. It was first discovered in Germany, but the species of crayfish is actually thought to be a mutated species of crayfish that's originally from North America. No one's really sure how this happened. It just did. And once you have one, then you have many. Except I've seen failure to reproduce a lot, and I think I finally got it dialed in. They actually much prefer to be in an unheated, unmanaged, outdoor large system. They like that better. In Madagascar, somehow or another, they ended up getting there, and then they got distributed, probably because hungry people think, oh, I can eat it, and it's invasive? Good. So they ended up in all the ditches and stuff, and now it's like a major food source there. So I'm growing them here in my outdoor aquatic systems, but I'm also kind of ramping up more of a controlled indoor production where I can start to make more that I know exactly where I put them in these outer tanks. And I'm going to be reconfiguring some of my outer tanks, basically making sure there's no fish in this. Like the big tanks at the bottom of the system will stay fish tanks, but the top like pitch and throw tanks, I'm going to kind of really make sure there's no goldfish in a lot of those is what I have right now. And when they get big enough, they will eat baby crayfish. The way my buddy David puts it, they'll eat anything they can fit in their friggin' mouth. People say they're not predators. Yeah, you're wrong, because I've seen it, right? So I'm going to put the structure in there more designed to be conducive to crayfish. They like lots of hiding places, but I also want to make it where it's easy for harvest. So I'm trying to basically make a freshwater shrimp food product, right, or freshwater mini lobster food product in my own backyard, and that's beginning to really work. And I know they're just watching those little guys with their claws walk around, and they're like, is that a Neocardania shrimp? No, that's a little crayfish. Is really, really cool. And one of the ones I got out of the tank, I'm absolutely sure was one of the originals that went in, because it ZZM is a beast. All right, now on the mushrooms, I just wanted to talk about this a little bit. So again, I got the Boom Room from North Spore, and this is just stuff you can look forward to seeing in the future. More and more mushrooms. I'm trying to figure out if I can get the timing down, if I can come up with a really cool mushroom thing that we can do at the workshop. But 100 people, that's a lot of mushrooms. I don't know. But maybe more like an appetizer or something that Ken can do for us instead of part of a meal. A really cool thing would be like king oyster. If you cut the stems, they're nice and round. They're about the diameter of a scallop. And you cut them about the thickness of a scallop, or a really big scallop cut in half. And you cook them the right way, they taste like scallops. You know, maybe I could do enough to do a couple of those for everybody that wanted to try them. Or, I don't know, a bunch of lion's mane steaks and everybody gets a piece as like an appetizer. Something like that. Because even with this Boom Room growing that many, I don't know. But the other side of this is, I believe in function stacking. So, like I said, I've been doing these cultures. And mostly with oyster because they're really easy. If you take an oyster mushroom and you cut the stem off of it and you split the stem in half, and you want to use good sanitation procedures. Basically, you should flame or alcohol clean the knife and anything that touches it. I'm going to be honest, I don't usually even do that because the oyster is so aggressive. And if I lose a culture, you can tell when one goes bad, so fine, I'll just throw that one away. It's all garbage anyway. I saw my grandson this morning. I'm like, I'm making this with garbage. He goes, that's garbage? I'm like, son, you got to start thinking beyond. I didn't say it was garbage. I said I made something of value with garbage. Anyway, that's how kids are. I build these cultures in these little, like, half-pint ball jars. And what I do is I use wide-mouth half-pint ball jars. It makes it easy to get everything out of them at the end. And the ones that don't taper in, they're straight so that there's no curved, because, again, it's easy to get everything out of them. And then I take the top, not the ring, but the top, I go out in my shop and I throw that in a vise. Don't do this with your hands because you can cut the shit out of yourself doing this with your hands if you try to hold it. Maybe a pair of vise grips or something you could do it with. I take a step bit. Now, it could just be a regular drill, but I have a step bit. And I drill a hole in there of about not quite a half inch. Probably one step down from the half inch step. And then I clean that and I put a piece of breathable first aid tape over the hole. That way the mycelium can breathe and exchange oxygen, but more crap doesn't go in there. I take all the stems, or if I'm doing something with, you know, a fruiting block, or I'm inoculating something with a block of spawn that I bought from a thing, I'll take a couple tablespoons and throw it in the bottom of the jar, and then I'll throw a couple tablespoons of coffee on top of either the mycelium from the active mushroom or from the spawn block, and within about 2 to 3 days, you really see mycelium start to just completely colonize that coffee. Now, since you're starting out with such a small amount, then we're just going to add maybe an inch of coffee grinds. And then when that gets colonized, another inch, and then another inch, until you get to the top. When you get to the top, you wait until the mycelium completely covers the top. Now, you could actually fruit that little jar, but you're probably going to get a very small cluster out of it because there's only so much fuel for it. I then take that, and I take my big-ass, like, 7-gallon cauldron pot, and I put about, I look how much coffee I have, and I put about an equal amount of wood pellets in it, which actually means they're going to expand more when you do what I'm going to say next. I take the wood pellets, and then I dump the coffee grinds, all the extra coffee grinds in, little filters and all included, and then I put in, you know, a couple cups of biochar. I mix it all up before I do the next step because it's much easier to mix while it's, you know, the coffee grinds are damp, but the wood pellets are dry and so is the biochar. So I mix it up really good. And then I take a tea kettle, throw it on the stove, and I boil water and I dump it in and I kind of mix it up with a spatula and look at it and go, eh, more water. So I do it till it gets about the right moisture and all of the pellets have dissolved in a sawdust. And then I stuff that into either like big Tupperware containers, again with holes in the lid with the tape over it, or I put them in a 1-gallon Ziploc garbage bag, and a Ziploc sandwich bag, like a gallon storage bag. And I cut a hole in the bag and I cover the bag hole with the tape. Now there's proper equipment to do this with especially more fussy mushrooms. But again, oysters are dead simple and they're very aggressive. I let that colonize, and then I either fruit that, okay, or I'll make 5 containers, right? And I'll do something with 4 of them, and the one, now I got a great big block that cost me $18, $28, depending on what it is from whatever supplier. except I made it myself out of garbage and some wood pellets. And I then multiply that again. And so I'm doing this more and more. And, you know, again, the kind of haphazard way I'm doing it, the lack of sanitation way I'm doing it, I haven't had a single culture get infected yet. I had one fail, as in the mycelium didn't colonize, but it just sat there and I eventually threw it in the compost. Now, here's the cool part. What I'm doing then is some of these blocks, and I picked this up from North Spore, I just take them out in the garden where there's an empty spot, dig a hole that I'm going to be able to fit the block in and still put about an inch of soil over it, throw some wood chips in the bottom because, hey, more carbon's more carbon, throw the block in there, cover it up, and I like to put that somewhere near an emitter where I know it's going to stay good and damp. So I'm going to have mushrooms popping up. I don't care how hot it is. I don't care how dry it is. Maybe they won't fruit during the heat. But sooner or later, those are going to go off, and I'm going to have more things. The other thing I'm doing is when a fruiting block has given me a cluster or two, or even with oysters, three, and I've got new blocks ready to go, and it was just taking up space, and it's not going to be as productive as it would be otherwise, that gets buried in the garden. Now, by adding the biochar, every time I drop a block in, I'm adding organic matter, I'm adding fungi activity, and I'm adding biochar. And I'm adding it at a depth of soil instead of spreading it out. So it's also, I have no need to worry about inoculation whatsoever of that biochar, do I? This is going to become one of my go-to methods going forward. And I think I might even start making kind of like little plugs, like doing mycelium colonization with a lot of these, like even just coffee grinds, in like red Solo cups, because then they pop right out and they just make little plugs all through the garden. I think this will be cool as shit. I can't see a downside to it, and that's a ton of biochar going in as well. What does the biochar do for the mushrooms? On some level, nothing, because it's not food. But on another level, it does a lot, because it keeps that nice open tilth, and it gives all those mycelium something to wrap around and grab onto. So it's just a great living environment, and it's also excellent at moisture retention, but more than that, moisture distribution. So when I started adding biochar to my own homemade potting soil, that's when I noticed that, like, even if it was a little too wet, once I added the biochar and mixed it up, all of a sudden the moisture just spread out. I didn't have wet spots and dry spots. I had even moisture and then longer retention. Both of those things are good for fungi. So just some fun stuff at the end. Anyway, guys, I appreciate you guys tuning in today. There hasn't been a flashback in a couple days. I'll see if I can get one out for you tomorrow. There's just been a lot going on lately. Remember, like, you guys that wanted an audio version of my book, yes, it's an AI voice, but it's pretty decent. You can listen to a sample. Laws of Life on audio is now available. 17 years of telling me to write a book in print, and I'm like, I'm a podcaster. You know, you got to write a book. So I wrote a book. Now you want it in audio. Okay, there it is, right? So there it is. And I appreciate everybody that's helped support the book so far. I hope everybody has a great weekend. Make it really productive. Take care, guys. I will catch you next week with a whole new round of shows. Run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.